Kann eine Karriere neugierig sein? Komm zu EY und erlebe es selbst. Arbeite an spannenden Projekten, gestalte die Wirtschaft von morgen und entwickle dich auch selbst weiter. Im Team Assurance, Tax, Consulting oder EY Parthenon, Strategy and Transactions. Shape your future with confidence. Jetzt bewerben auf jobsgermany.ey.com.
This is True Crime Psychology and Personality, where we discuss the pathology behind some of the most horrific crimes and those who committed them from a scientifically informed perspective.
I'm Dr. Todd Grande. I have a PhD in counselor education and supervision, and I'm a licensed professional counselor of mental health. Dr. Todd Grande, that's my YouTube channel.
Today's question is, can I analyze the case of Kimberly Cates? First, I'll look at the background of this case, move to the timeline of the crime, then offer my analysis. Kimberly Cates was born on March 6, 1967, in Toledo, Ohio. She graduated from a community college in Tucson, Arizona, and worked at a medical center as a nurse. In 1997, she married a man named David. The couple had a daughter named Jamie Wynn Cates in 1998. The family moved to Baltimore, Maryland, and in 2004, moved to Mount Vernon, New Hampshire. This town of 2,500 is 15 miles northwest of Nashua. The family lived in a house on Trow Road as Kimberly worked at a few different hospitals in the area. About 10 miles south of Mount Vernon, in the town of Brookline, New Hampshire, lived a teenager named Stephen Spader. He had been born on November 9, 1991, in the state of Arizona. His mother was unable or unwilling to regulate her intake of substances. Stephen had cocaine and marijuana in his system when he was born. At 5 days old, he was adopted by a couple named Stephen and Christine Spader, who raised him in Brookline, New Hampshire. Stephen appeared to have a normal childhood. His parents were supportive and took him on vacations. He was described as personable and would often play with other children. Despite being limited in his athletic ability by asthma and flat feet, Stephen became a Boy Scout. As he grew older, he struggled managing his mood and used cocaine and marijuana. Eventually, he dropped out of high school and earned a GED. Stephen had a friend named Christopher Gribble, who had been born on October 18, 1989. Christopher was homeschooled by his parents. He was a devout Mormon who wanted to become a missionary someday. Like Stephen, Christopher was a Boy Scout. After failing a training course to become a Marine, Christopher's demeanor drastically changed, and he became antisocial. Sometime around September 2009, Stephen established a club he called the Disciples of Destruction. This organization did not have a clear purpose, although making money was one of the goals. Stephen said the club was based on loyalty and brotherhood. He recruited Christopher, as well as two other friends, William Marks and Quinn Glover. Eager to activate his new criminal organization, Stephen planned a heinous crime. Before moving to the timeline of the crime, let's hear a word from today's sponsor, Delete Me. Over the past few years, I have covered a lot of stalking cases which involve a perpetrator easily finding personal information online. When people try to get this information removed, they find it's extremely time-consuming. Fortunately, there is a solution. DeleteMe is a subscription service that can eliminate this type of personal information that is for sale online. They have the straightforward mission of removing customers' information from search results and upholding your right to manage and remove your personal information. The privacy experts at DeleteMe work continually to remove information from over 750 data brokers. This gets rid of your personal data like address, occupation, marital status, age, names of relatives, and so on. How does it work? Submit your information to DeleteMe, and their experts remove it. After that, they check every 3 months to make sure any new data get removed as well. If you want to get your personal information removed from search results on the web, go to joindeleteme.com/Dr. Grande. DeleteMe is offering 20% off their privacy plans to all my viewers with my code, Dr. Grande. Again, that's joindeleteme.com/Dr. Grande, promo code Dr. Grande. Now moving to the timeline of the crime. On October 4, 2009, at about 4 a.m., Stephen, Christopher, William, and Quinn broke into the residence of the Cates family on Trow Road in Mount Vernon, New Hampshire. Stephen's intent was to murder the occupants of the house and to steal property. He had no prior connection to the Cates family. 42-year-old Kimberly Cates and her 11-year-old daughter, Jamie, were the only people in the house. Kimberly's husband, David, was on a business trip at that time. The home invaders deactivated the electricity and used an iPod as a flashlight to navigate the house. Stephen and Christopher entered the master bedroom where they found Kimberly. She woke up and said, "Jamie, is that you?" At this point, Stephen attacked Kimberly with a machete, striking her 36 times. Jamie was also in the room. She attempted to escape, but Christopher stabbed her in the face and chest before throwing her against a door. Seriously wounded, Jamie pretended to be dead and was able to trick her attackers. The men reactivated the electricity and took various items from the house before leaving. Jamie used a phone to call for help. When the police arrived, they found Jamie seriously wounded and her mother, Kimberly, dead. It was clear from the evidence at the scene that a home invasion had taken place, but the police didn't know who was responsible. This would quickly change after Stephen and Christopher told friends about the crime. Not realizing that Jamie survived, they claimed they killed a mother and her daughter in a home invasion. The police interviewed the men, who initially denied any involvement in the crime, but then Christopher confessed. The men were arrested on October 6. Stephen and Christopher were charged with first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, attempted murder, conspiracy to commit burglary, and witness tampering. The police also arrested William and Quinn, who agreed to testify against Stephen and Christopher. On November 9, 2010, which was Stephen Spader's 19th birthday, he was found guilty. He received a term of life in prison without the possibility of parole, plus 76 years. The judge said to him, "You will stay in a cage for the rest of your pointless life." On March 25, 2011, Christopher Gribble was found guilty. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The judge said, quote, "Infinity is not enough jail time," unquote. While I appreciate the judge may have been using hyperbole, the lack of understanding about mathematics is still worrisome. As far as the other two men directly involved with the crime, William Marks was sentenced to 30 to 60 years in prison for conspiracy to commit murder, burglary, and first-degree assault. Quinn Glover pleaded guilty to robbery and two counts of burglary. He received 20 to 40 years. He could be released as early as 2029. Reportedly, he is a model inmate. Now moving to my analysis. Here are my thoughts on a few areas that stood out to me in this case. Item number one. It appears as though Stephen Spader was the mastermind of this terrible crime. He had a troubled history. As I mentioned, he had cocaine and marijuana in his system when he was born. As he grew older, Stephen's behavior became disturbing. Before dropping out of high school, Stephen played the character Daddy Warbucks in a school production of Annie. Unfortunately for Stephen, he had a hard knock life, and the sun did not come out tomorrow. His behavior continued to cause alarm. His adoptive parents noticed this and took him to a mental health clinician for the first time in October 2006. Stephen would end up seeing several different mental health clinicians over the years. In November 2007, Stephen's mood became even worse after he met a girl at a friend's birthday party. They had an intense and turbulent romantic relationship. Stephen listened to music featuring a theme of violence, bragged about killing people, used substances, and told people he was a gangster. 2008 was a big year for Stephen. He spent time in mental health facilities twice this year, ran away with his love interest, only to be discovered by the police in New York and returned to New Hampshire, pointed a knife at his father, and on another occasion, stabbed the counters at his residence. In May 2008, his parents enrolled him in a $500 a day leadership program. I always find it curious when these treatment programs use the word leadership, like they're trying to avoid using the words mental health. Stephen only lasted 2 weeks. The staff there said he needed a higher level of treatment than they could provide. I guess they just couldn't infuse him with enough leadership. Stephen was taken directly to a residential treatment center in Utah, which cost $9,000 a month. He left less than a month later. Ultimately, Stephen was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder and had both narcissistic and borderline personality traits. He was obsessed with being infamous. Item number two, Stephen's conspirator, Christopher Gribble, also had many problems. He did not fit in with his peers, was socially awkward, and had nervous laughter. Normally, he was quiet, but when he did talk, he overdid it. He would ramble on, even when the person he was talking to was giving him clear signals that they were ready to leave. He could not pick up on social cues. Christopher was desperate for love and frequently believed he was falling in love with various girls. In reality, he made these girls extremely uncomfortable. People referred to Christopher as Creepy Chris. Despite being wrong frequently on various topics, Chris worked diligently to prove he was right. He could not admit a failure. He was arrogant and grandiose. In prison, Christopher did not want to be treated by mental health counselors. His defense attorney said that he had antisocial personality disorder. As far as his motive for the murder, Christopher told the police that he had wanted to kill someone for a long time. He was disappointed that he did not feel any emotion after being involved in the murder. His greatest regret in life was that he didn't kill Jamie because now she had to live with what happened. If he could go back in time, he would kill her. Item number three, there's no question that the crime in this case was premeditated. When Stephen formed his little antisocial club, the Disciples of Destruction, he told his conspirators that he wanted to break into homes and murder the occupants. He tried to figure out how to obtain chloroform because he wanted to kidnap and torture his victims. He also talked about cooking and eating them, putting their heads on stakes, and staging their bodies for the media. Stephen's behavior around the time of the murder was described as euphoric. He was unable to contain his giddiness, joy, and excitement. Item number four, Stephen tried to manipulate the authorities to escape justice. He wanted a plea deal, which would place him in a prison as far north as possible. His reason for this placement was to be close to Canada. Stephen's plan involved building a criminal enterprise in prison, escaping, crossing the border into Canada, and using the money from his business to survive indefinitely. No one could possibly catch him in Canada. Apparently, he was unaware that Canadians have access to the internet and to law enforcement. Item number five, because Stephen was 17 when he committed the murder, he was granted a hearing to be resentenced. He decided not to attend the hearing and directed his attorneys not to do anything on his behalf. He did not want a sentence reduction. He said he was the most sick and twisted person you'll ever meet, and he did not expect forgiveness or deserve forgiveness. As it turns out, the court agreed with Stephen's assessment. He was denied a new sentence. In prison, Stephen has been described as a model inmate who is polite and subdued. He watches his intake of carbohydrates and exercises regularly. Stephen finally found an environment where he fits in. Item number six, what do I think happened in this case? This is just a theory, my opinion. Stephen was self-centered, impulsive, irresponsible, arrogant, grandiose, cold, callous, sadistic, irrational, excitement-seeking, aggressive, and had a sense of entitlement. His adoptive parents did everything possible to help him. They repeatedly connected him with mental health services, but nothing helped significantly. Stephen remained in a downward spiral and entertained unsettling fantasies. Without any empathy, there were no safeties on his behavior, no limit to what he was capable of. Stephen was interested in far more than homicide. He wanted his victims to suffer. His stated plan of trying to obtain money was secondary. Stephen's primary interest was sexual domination. With his set of personality characteristics, Stephen could have gone on to commit several murders. At some point, he connected with Christopher, a man who shared many of his characteristics, like sadism and excitement seeking. Unfortunately, they not only found each other, they found two other conspirators. It was only a matter of time before Stephen and Christopher committed murder. They were trapped in a loop of dark and disturbing thoughts. Instead of being the disciples of destruction, they were more like disciples of dysfunction.
This has been True Crime Psychology and Personality from Ars Longa Media. This content is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.